I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This weekend, the drug manufacturer Merck & Company took out a full-page newspaper ad defending the timing of its decision to pull its popular painkiller Vioxx off the market. Studies link that drug to a higher incidence of heart attacks, and recent news stories have criticized Merck, saying that the company knew about the problems years before it withdrew the drug. Merck insists that it extensively studied and promptly disclosed clinical data, but executives at Merck have good reason to worry. Their company is now the subject of a criminal probe by the Justice Department. Merck's already had hundreds of legal suits leveled against it by consumers. But it's actually more than Merck on the spit here. The Food and Drug Administration is the federal agency that's supposed to approve the use and the labeling of drugs and to safeguard consumers. And so how well is the FDA doing its job? We'd like to have your thoughts this hour. Do you believe the FDA is looking out for your interests or the interests of the big drug companies? What is it that needs to change? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in just a moment, we will talk with the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, who's been very critical of both the FDA and the drug companies. First, though, to Mark Kaufman. Mark's a reporter with the Washington Post, working on the national desk and covering this story. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Can you summarize briefly for us what it is that brings both Merck and the FDA before the Senate Finance Committee later this week?
Certainly. The withdrawal of Vioxx is the proximate cause right now, this is something that's been building for some time. But specifically, Vioxx was taken off the market in September. This is a painkiller, arthritis painkiller, that has become one of the most popular drugs in the world. It came on the market, I believe, in 1999 or 2000. There was an enormous amount of direct-to-consumer advertising that quickly made it very popular. And then very quickly, there were signals that came out of data suggesting that there might be some problems here, that there might be cardiovascular risks. It was kept on the market. The FDA reviewed it, made some kind of warnings on the label, but kept it on the market. And then just in September, a safety committee that was overseeing an additional clinical trial of Vioxx found a clear signal of the cardiovascular risks, and then it was taken off the market. The question then became, did Merck act quickly enough? Was the FDA acting properly in allowing it on the market and allowing it to be so aggressively advertised? And then from that comes the larger issues of, well, is Vioxx an exception, or is that something that is happening a lot, where the FDA is perhaps not giving the kind of oversight that patients or that consumers expect that's going to be there?
Tell me why it is, though, this comes before the Senate Finance Committee. Is that the committee that oversees the FDA?
Well, there are a lot of committees oversee the FDA. I mean, ironically, the budget of the FDA comes through the House Agriculture Committee. Primarily, this is a function of Senator Charles Grassley, who in recent months and years has taken a very strong interest in the FDA and drug issues. And so he is the one who is pushing it. He's using his technical oversight of some federal programs that purchase drugs as a way into the oversight. But it's primarily his own very strong personal interest in this.
Quick last question, Mark. I mentioned earlier in the program that the Justice Department has a probe going. The SEC is looking into this. There's all those lawsuits. But when we talk about the attitude of Congress, is this just a committee hearing that is designed to show that the politicians are looking at something that the public's concerned about? Or do you think that there's any real appetite for reform there?
Well, some of both. Clearly, on the part of someone like Senator Grassley, there is an appetite for reform. There are a number of offices within the FDA, one of them being the Office of Drug Safety. That's a very small office. that doesn't get a great deal of resource, and that is also directly under the Office of New Drugs, which is where drugs are reviewed and then approved. And Senator Grassley is interested in making that an independent office, the Office of Drug Safety, that would be out of the purview of the people who are actually making the decisions on whether or not to approve a drug. But that said, I think that reasonable people could easily look back to Congress as being the source of a lot of the questions coming up now about the FDA. Going back to 1994, Congress initiated a User Fee Act that allowed the drug companies or forced the drug companies to pay for some of their oversight. Over time, that has now amounted to more than half of the FDA budget, and this was primarily because Congress would not appropriate sufficient funds on its own, taxpayer funds. So now we have the industry paying more than half of the salary of the people who are reviewing the drugs, and that clearly raises questions.
And that's actually where I want to take this further in the hour. But, Mark, I'm going to let you go, and thank you for being with us. Good to have you on the program.
Sure. Thank you.
Mark Kaufman, a Washington Post reporter on the National Desk, who's covering this story. I want to introduce Marcia Angel, who's here with me in the studio. She's a senior lecturer in the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, also former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. But you'll probably know her better for her recent book. It's called The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. Marcia, it's nice to have you here in the studio.
Thanks, Dick. It's good to be here.
Now, the FDA, could that agency have blown the whistle on Merck, on Vioxx much earlier? Do we know?
Oh, it certainly could. The facts about Vioxx were, in a sense, hidden in open view. They published an important paper in 2000 in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed a 4- to 5-fold increase in the risk of heart attacks in people who took Vioxx as compared with people who took naproxen, which is Aleve, sold over the counter as Aleve. That was a wake-up call. That was the point at which both the company and the FDA should have said, we are going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to find out, we're going to confirm this or show that it's not true right now and mount the clinical trial that would do that.
Now, we know that they did meet at that time and they talked about those issues. But
a little bit later they
did.
But by this time, there was evidence to the same effect coming in from other sources, epidemiologic studies. This is a different kind of study. It's considered somewhat less reliable. But still, it's the kind of study that told us that cigarettes cause lung cancer. Nobody ever did a randomized clinical trial of that. So they can be very, very important. And they were showing the same thing. A body of evidence was amassing that indicated 4 years ago that there was big trouble with this drug. The company kept advertising it as though it could make you skate like Dorothy Hamill. They spent far more on direct-to-consumer ads for Vioxx than it would have cost to mount a huge study to find out yes or no.
And why wouldn't the FDA at some point have said, you know what, we're a little worried about this. We have independent scientists here who look at this increase in the rate of heart attacks and possible deaths among people who are taking Vioxx. So if you're not going to pull it off the market, we're going to tell you to pull it off the market.
Or tell you to mount an appropriate clinical trial to answer the question. The reason, in a nutshell, is that this agency on which we are all dependent, it's a vital agency, has become the captive to some extent of the industry it regulates. And that is a very dangerous situation.
This is the story that Mark was beginning to tell
yes.
us about the, let me see if I can get it right, the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, right?
That's right. That's right. That was enacted by Congress in 1992. At that time, drug companies, to get a drug reviewed and approved, had to pay about $300,000 in a user fee. That term offends me right there because it suggests that the users are the drug companies.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the users
or
of the FDA are you and me. But that's what they did. And the money was not to be used in general by the FDA. There was a quid pro quo. It was to be used only to speed up the review and approval of new drugs. The reason being that that eats into the patent life of drugs. Before the clinical trials are done, the drug is usually patented. And so the drug companies are in a huge hurry to get those drugs on the market.
Because it's only in that patent period that the drug company gets to sell it for, on its own, for a high price with no competition, right?
Yes, exactly. And the time it takes to bring a drug from its preclinical testing stage, by the time you have a candidate drug, through clinical trials to approval is maybe 6 years. But that eats into the patent life of the drug. Certainly the time for clinical trials does, and the time that it's evaluated by the FDA. So the drug companies wanted to speed up the FDA. Now, that was only a small portion of this time anyway, but they wanted to speed it up. So the money, the user fees, were specifically to hire people in the section called Center for Drug Evaluation and Review, the center that looks at new drug applications, to hire people. And since the PDUFA, that's the name of this act, was implemented, they have added 1,500 more people to review drugs in a hurry that are paid by the companies whose drugs they are reviewing.
What's the difference between
what's
the difference between the length of time it took a drug to be approved before this act and today?
Before maybe 2 years. Today, if it is a new drug, that is what they call a priority review, they're reviewed in 6 months or less now. On average, it's about a year for all of the Me Too drugs and the other less important drugs.
Now, there's another piece of history that's important here, and that is that back in the early 90s, there was a big public push on to get drugs for HIV/AIDS moved through the FDA because people were willing to sort of take them at any stage, right?
Yes, and I think quite appropriately in the 80s, as a result of the HIV activists, the FDA changed some of its very bureaucratic, slow way of doing things to get these HIV drugs on the market in a hurry, and I think that that's appropriate. But since then, the drug companies have taken advantage of that for commercial reasons, and they suggest that somehow the nation should be in a huge hurry for the very next Me Too drug, and are using the rhetoric of the 80s and now trying to stampede the FDA to approve their drugs in a hurry and get them out there. And the FDA is doing that.
Is Vioxx one of these? One of the drugs
that was,
that came quickly through the FDA?
I don't remember exactly how long it took, but that's a good example of a Me Too drug. Celebrex was approved, same kind of drug, approved 4 months, I think, before Vioxx was. So there was a drug already on the market that claimed to do the same thing. I should say neither of these drugs has ever been shown to be better at relieving the symptoms of arthritis than Advil or Aleve. What they were supposed to be able to do is protect you from the gastrointestinal side effects better. There's a lot of question about that, too.
And we will talk a little bit further on in the program about those Me Too drugs, the amount of time and effort and money and energy that goes into just producing a drug that competes with one of your competitors rather than doing some original research and looking for something like a flu vaccine or cancer drugs. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the FDA and what our own expectations are of this federal agency when it comes to approving and guaranteeing our safety for the drugs it's looking at. Once again, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection this hour. We're talking about the work of the Food and Drug Administration in its capacity as regulating the approval of and then monitoring the drugs that are on the market, whether or not it's doing the job it should. It's been brought into some sharp focus with the recent criticism over the Merck & Company drug, Vioxx. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Marcia Angel is here with me in the studio. She's author of a book called The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do about it. She's former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. And there's one more point that I wanted to try and cover about your understanding of the way this speeded-up process works, Marcia. You say it's faster, but does that mean that there's actually less clinical work being done in approving new drugs?
There can be. In 1997, Congress enacted another act that specifically says that in some cases the FDA can approve a drug on the basis of just one clinical trial. It used to be that there had to be two or more. And here again, the notion was that even though the drug would get on the market on the basis of less good scientific evidence, the drug companies in most cases would be required to do what's called post-marketing studies, to do studies to make sure that it was indeed safe and effective. But these are called commitment studies because the drug companies promised they would do these studies. They don't do it. They simply ignore that. So most of the commitment studies the drug companies have said that they would do, have been told that they should do, haven't even been started yet.
And the FDA then is not necessarily in a position to say, right, okay, Vioxx has been on the market for 2 years. Let's have a look at the clinical data that you've gathered together to see if it's
Well, they can say that. They can say that, but they don't. They just sit on their hands while the companies flout their commitments to look at these things. In the case of Vioxx, the FDA could have said, you mount a large clinical trial right now, or we take it off the market. Or they could have taken it off the market on the basis of the evidence they had, and many people feel that they should have.
So when we look back at the way that the work of the FDA changed under this Prescription Drug User Fee Act, PDUFA, as you call it, did it actually cause a shift in priorities?
Absolutely,
at the FDA.
Absolutely. The FDA, it also does food and cosmetics and so forth, but the FDA in looking at prescription drugs is not just looking at the evidence on which to put them on the market. It's also supposed to be monitoring them for safety. It's supposed to be inspecting the manufacturing plants of FDA-approved drugs wherever in the world they are. It's supposed to be regulating marketing. And those functions have been starved in favor of getting more drugs out faster, whether they're useful drugs or not. So,
in part because they earn the fees when they do that work.
Well, that's right. And because the other parts of the FDA are dependent on public financing, which has been decreased. So, for example, the flu vaccine that was taken off the market, this was an American company, Chiron, that made this vaccine. They manufactured it in Britain and in other places. The FDA should have been inspecting that plant. It was the British who found that the plant was contaminated, not the Americans. So the inspection of manufacturing standards is very lax now. And certainly the regulation of marketing is lax. In Vioxx, that's a good example. We saw Dorothy Hamill skating all over and telling us that Vioxx was the greatest thing since sliced bread. We didn't hear about the indications that it increased the risk of heart attacks and strokes.
Okay, let's bring Sam Kasman into the conversation. He's joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C., where he works as chief counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That's a nonprofit public policy organization dedicated to the principle of limited-size government. Hello, Sam.
Hi, good morning.
You've been listening along. How do you see this problem at the FDA? What would you change?
Well, I think, first of all, almost all the discussion I've heard has been along the notion that it's only the drug industry that really has an interest in speeding up drug approvals. And I think that is essentially wrong. Whether you're talking about breakthrough drugs or me-too drugs, there are always people who are served by new drugs coming onto the market. And the real tragedy of FDA regulation going back for decades is that this is an inherently overcautious agency.
Isn't that a good thing at one level, Sam, to have an agency?
I mean, caution is a good thing, but if you're in a certain emergency situation, if you've got untreatable diseases or diseases that are only badly treatable, over-caution can be a bad thing. It can even be deadly. If I'm drowning and you're about to throw me a life rope and someone steps in and wants to see the paperwork on that life rope, by the time that person is done, I may well have gone under for good.
So would you have just the drug companies themselves being responsible for the testing and say, you know, if you take the drugs and they don't work out, you can sue them. And that way you could skip the FDA altogether.
If I had my druthers, I would take away FDA's veto power and turn it into what I could describe as a certifying agency. Right now, FDA essentially can veto any drug that does not meet its criteria of safety and effectiveness. I would not change those standards. I would simply allow unapproved therapies to be available under medical supervision and with very clear warning of the fact that FDA has not approved them. And what that would mean is that for people who trust FDA, whether they're doctors or patients, nothing at all would change. They would go on using only government-approved therapies. But in the short run, you would be creating a new choice for people who, for some reason or another, have to go beyond what FDA has approved and who have a doctor who agrees with them. In the long run, I think that option would actually improve FDA because it would lead to the creation of other medical entities in the business of rapidly evaluating new therapies. Doctors could turn to those entities to see just what their recommendations are, just as doctors now often look at what foreign countries have approved certain therapies when they're trying to get an idea of what's good and what isn't. And either FDA would have to compete, would have to get better at coming out with better evaluations more quickly, or it would sink into irrelevance. But really, you've got to remember that in terms of the political powers at play here, the politics and journalism of all this, FDA is always going to be much more scared about approving a therapy that turns out to be, have bad surprises, and it's going to be less scared about delaying or denying a therapy that people really need.
Because, let me take the one part of what you were saying a little bit earlier and bring Marcia back in, because one of the things, Marcia, that you write about is that we need to understand somehow the difference between the advice that we would get from our doctor and the advice that we would get from a scientist in a lab who is studying the drug. Now, if I understand what Sam's saying, he said, you know, I'm the patient. My doctor's going to tell me that this drug may or may not be good for me, the salvation for whatever ails me. What's the problem with that?
The doctor has no way of knowing any more than you do. One of the great advances of 20th century medicine was the development of the randomized controlled clinical trial. We learned the hard way that anecdotes are not good enough. If a patient said, I just took this pill and I'm feeling better, that doesn't tell you that the pill made him better. The pill may have made him worse. He may have done better without any pill. It's no way. It takes you back to the days of leeches and purging. Scientific medicine is a great advance because it tells you how to find out whether a drug works or not. The doctor can't look at the bottle of pills and say, oh, yes, this is the antibiotic that's going to cure your pneumonia. And if he tries it to see whether it cures your pneumonia, it's very dangerous. It's a very dangerous and unreliable way of evaluating a drug.
Okay, we're going to take our first call from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Now, Paul is joining us on the line. Hi, Paul.
Dick, how are you?
Thanks for calling.
As a very quick preamble, I should say, and it might be something you might want to address, is that I am a caregiver taking care of my father who has heart failure, and early on he rejected Vioxx out of hand without even trying it. So now he's emboldened about even trying new medication. He's new medication shy. But that's the reason why I'm calling essentially is even though I come down on Marcia's side in many respects, I've heard her on other programs, I must address the issue of Me Too drugs in terms of side effects of one medication in one class. My father has used the angiotensin receptor blocker, ARB, medication, which is in one case used for hypertension, and there's a suspicion that it may help in heart failure, chronic heart failure. Well, the fact is that there are a number of medications to choose from. My father had a side effect of one, tried another, hasn't had a problem with it. Now, that doesn't tell us anything over the long run, but the fact is the Me Too drugs do sometimes add an opportunity for patients who have a problem with one drug in the same classification to try another.
Let's hear from Marcia on that.
Well, that's an assertion. Here again, the anecdote is fairly unreliable. it's most likely that these Me Too drugs are similar, not only in their effectiveness, but in their side effects. But there's no way to know for sure because the companies never test them head-to-head at equivalent doses. They don't want to know the answer. So we don't really...
Well, why wouldn't they? I mean, why wouldn't they do a Pepsi test on these drugs so they could say our heart drug actually is better than their heart drug?
Because it may be worse. That's the problem. It may be worse. And the drug companies also don't test their drugs on patients like the caller's father.
Right.
They don't test a new drug against an old one or against a placebo in people who have failed on the old one. They don't want to know these things. They just use their marketing muscle to try to convince both doctors and patients that a new Me Too drug is better in some way. For all we know, each successive Me Too drug is worse than the one before. We have no way of knowing whether they're better or worse or the same. And the notion that they provide backup is simply an assertion until it's tested, and it hasn't been tested.
Paul, back to you.
That makes perfect scientific sense in terms of studying something from the standpoint of research, but anecdotal evidence sometimes makes some sense as well. And all I can do is talk about the short-term observations of seeing a patient who is my father have side effects immediately of one medication, and the cardiologist changes the medication to the same classification, just a different drug without side effects, and then the patient continues to take it. Now, they may take it under their peril without the kind of necessary research and clinical procedure that Marcia speaks to, but the fact is the right, at this moment, maybe it's immediate gratification, the patient is not experiencing side effects and goes along with a new medication from the same class.
And Sam Kasman, this plays in part to what you were saying, where ultimately, it should be those who want to consume the drugs who can make those decisions and take those risks?
Absolutely. And if a there are lots of doctors who will swear that they have sets of patients who simply could not tolerate other pain-relieving drugs the way they tolerated Vioxx. And in my view, those folks and those doctors ought to be able to continue using Vioxx in that manner. And really, one question you ought to get to is, why wouldn't it suffice for the warning, the cardiovascular warning regarding risks on Vioxx simply to be strengthened and for that drug to stay on the market? And I think the answer there is because the current liability system just makes it impossible for Merck to keep doing that. And I think that ends up being a disservice to patients like your caller's father.
Let's go to another caller, to Somerville, Massachusetts now. Joseph's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Dick. Thank you very much. I have a question directed to Marcia.
Yeah.
I'm trained as a physician, and I am not a clinical doctor, but I have a specialty in medical toxicology, and I investigate the health effects of hazardous substances. And I know that for each substance that I am asked to look into, it takes me a tremendous amount of time to come to a judgment as to what the health effects are in a given exposure situation. And it always amazes me how physicians can so easily prescribe medications, even in the subspecialties. And I'd like to ask Marcia, how is it that any clinical doctor can really know that a given medication is really safe or not, given the amount of time it would take to really look into it and make sure that it is?
That is why we have an FDA. The doctor can't know without the FDA. And even in the case of the angiotensin blockers that the earlier caller was mentioning, these have all gone through FDA approval. They have been shown in clinical trials that the companies have to sponsor that these drugs are reasonably safe and effective. If we did not have that regulation, you can only imagine what would be sold. In fact, if you go back to the creation of the FDA, it was created precisely because of the scandals in the meatpacking industry. This was back in 1906. The fact
snake
that,
oil time,
that
wasn't it,
well,
really?
It was worse than snake oil. I mean, dangerous, worthless patent remedies being sold. We are utterly dependent, and we shouldn't forget that, on the FDA to make sure that drugs are reasonably safe and effective. The doctor, thank God, does not have to do what the toxicologist does. He does not have to start from scratch and try to mount his own study to find out whether drugs are safe and effective.
So, Joseph, are you saying that we need that independent agency to make those judgments?
Well, Dick, in a sense, but I'm also saying that there's a concern that if each physician is depending on the legitimacy and validity of information coming from others, which really is the case because no individual doctor or hardly any really has the time to look into it for themselves, for herself, for himself. And Marcia is asserting that the FDA is not a source of information that is reliable. I wonder what that says about the confidence that patients should have when they go into the clinical setting.
Well, let me, if I can, put that to Sam Kasman, because that's the argument he's putting forward. What we're hearing, Sam, is that the doctor cannot know the answer to the question that you're hoping the doctor will be able to answer.
Well, I think doctors generally recognize the limits of their own knowledge, and they know when to look elsewhere, and they know where to look. And one case that arises all the time is when you get to the phenomenon of what's called off-label use. A drug is approved by FDA for a specific illness, for a specific type of therapy. Once it's approved, though, any physician is free to prescribe it for any use that he or she thinks is medically appropriate. And what that means is, for example, in the area of cancer chemotherapy, by some where you have a certain drug approved for chemotherapy in isolation against a specific tumor, you also have lots of doctors using it, often very effectively, for treating other cancers. That is off-label use. That is not a use in which FDA has instructed them. And yet, quite often, this off-label use becomes the standard of medical care. In a sense, a doctor would almost be guilty of malpractice not to do this. And what that illustrates is that doctors, either individually or in consultation with each other or by looking at other practices, can figure out what to do with medicines even when FDA is not guiding them by the hand.
Okay, we've got just a few seconds before we have to take another break. But, Marcia, you're shaking your head. You disagree with the
yes.
off-label example?
Yes, because when he says used effectively, you don't know unless you've done the clinical trials. And then they would go in probably to get FDA approval for that use. So doctors do sometimes use drugs for off-label uses, but way too much. And he ignores the effect of marketing by these massive companies that convinces doctors to use drugs for all sorts of things for which they're not approved.
All right, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you approve of the way the FDA is looking after your interests when it comes to the safety of pharmaceuticals? We're watching the story unfold with Vioxx right now to see if that is an example. There's certainly a lot of people also looking at that, but we're interested in hearing from you whether or not you think the FDA should be even tougher with the drugs, even if it means they're coming a little slower to you. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection with me on the program this hour, Marcia Angel. She is author of The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. She's currently a senior lecturer at the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Sam Kasman's also with us. He's chief counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute and advocating for a more streamlined, more stripped-down version of the FDA. We'd like to hear what you think about the FDA and the way that the drug companies talk to us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our next call from Davenport, Iowa. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. What do you think?
Well, years ago, I used to challenge my father-in-law, who was a general practitioner, on how a lot of the cruises and in-house lunches and event tickets that were always handed to him through drug companies. And he used to respond by saying that, well, you have to weigh it against the fact that they are not allowed to advertise in the mass media through magazine and television. And obviously this has changed, and they can now, but the tickets and these lunches still continue to flow. And my question is, in the wake of all this, do you feel that the FDA is any way compromising their ability to do their job by the massive ad campaigns? And also, in the effect of the Merck investigation, do you see any sort of a spidering investigation that will look back in terms of the marketing and how it does affect the general public and the drug company's marketing practice?
Let's just take the first one if we can, to keep it simple here. I think, Marcia, you came up with a figure of over $50 billion that they major drug companies spend on marketing, right?
That was several years ago. I looked at the top 10 U.S. drug companies in 2002. They had sales that year of $217 billion. They spent, to give you the proportion, they spent 14% of their sales on research and development, or $30 billion that year. But they spent 31%, more than twice as much, or $67 billion on marketing and administration. They lump those two things together, but you can calculate, you can estimate, based on the one company that doesn't lump them together, that about 85% of that total, or $57 billion, was spent on marketing. $57 billion, almost twice what they spend on R&D.
So what's wrong with a drug company telling people that this is what its drug will do, or this is what it says its drug will do?
Well, they don't know what its drug will do, because most of the marketing is for me-too drugs where there is absolutely no good evidence that one is better than another. And they're trying to convince doctors and patients to choose one of these over the other. And the one they want them to choose is usually the most expensive one with a long patent life ahead of it, rather than a generic or an older drug that's going off patent. That's where the marketing muscle goes. Now, we're all aware of the direct-to-consumer ads because we see them every day, but that is chicken feed compared with what they spend on convincing doctors to prescribe their drugs. They pour billions into advertising to doctors. They call it different things. Much of it they call education of doctors. But you don't look to a company for impartial education about a product it sells. They spend tens of billions educating doctors, and they educate them all right. They educate them to believe that new drugs are better than old ones in the absence of any good evidence, and they educate them in a very drug-intensive style of medicine. If somebody comes in with heartburn, the doctor very quickly will put that patient on Nexium, often reaching into his cabinet to pull out a free sample. And the free samples are always for very expensive Me Too drugs. Rather than to say, you need to lose some weight, or you need to stop eating three Big Macs in a row. They learn that for every ailment and discontent, there is a drug, and to use it.
Now, there was a news story this morning on the radio, Sam Kasman, this one is for you, where the FDA did step in and say to one of the makers of the erectile dysfunction drugs, I think it was Viagra, but I'm not sure.
It was.
That you're no longer allowed to use the ad that has a couple sort of dancing down a sidewalk and talking about, getting back to those sexual urges days of the 1920s, because it was, a form of false advertising.
Look, I think those are incredibly funny ads. The notion that the fact they didn't mention side effects, as if, you're really going to learn about side effects from a 15 or 30 second or even 60 second ad is nonsense. Remember, these folks still have to go to a doctor to get the prescription for this. But the real point of FDA's ad, I think, of FDA's response here is it's claimed that there is no proof that these drugs like Viagra can return someone to their former level of sexual potency. And look, if there's anyone in a good position to tell whether a drug does that or not, I think it's the individual layman, and you don't need a federal agency insisting on clinical proof of that.
So,
but I think more broadly, the notion that there's something wrong with advertising is really an incredibly elitist approach. It is the idea that there's certain knowledge out there, but it's only fit to be put in the hands of some a clerical priesthood, and that the common people or their doctors are somehow incapable of dealing with that. Frankly, I think the policy decision on that was made over 200 years ago when the First Amendment was drafted.
Well, it's acknowledged that the FDA does have purview over direct-to-consumer advertising and advertising to doctors. So it's not a question of the First Amendment rights. They are regulated.
Let's take it, though, in the spirit that Sam says. I mean, I don't, if I look at an ad for a pair of jeans and say, boy, I'm really going to look great if I buy those jeans, I'm as gullible as the person who goes to his doctor and says, I want Viagra, I want whatever I've seen. Like, isn't buyer beware adequate here, Marcia?
Of course not. It's not adequate for life-saving drugs. Can you really, if you have pneumonia, look at a pill and decide whether that's going to cure your pneumonia? And suppose you're wrong. Or can you imagine in medical devices, you need an artificial heart valve. You don't know whether it's going to fracture the next day and you'll die suddenly. You need the protection of the FDA. There's nothing elitist about scientific research to find out whether something truly works or not.
1-800-423-8255. Back to our callers now. To Cambridge next, and Sam's on the line from there. Hi, Sam.
Hi. The council from Washington mentioned a while ago that that slowing down the process for whatever the other reasons are, one of the things that might prevent critical stuff from coming to market. And my sense is, I just wondered whether that's kind of throwing the fear factor out there to lift up the floodgates. And the question I have is, you know, how many of the drugs that are in the trough, the pipe to get reviewed would be considered critical, and how many are just drugs that could certainly wait for another few months to be proven safe? Because, in fact, sometimes I think these things deal with something that's less, that could be much worse for bad side effects.
No, it's a good question. And Sam, you made the point a little bit earlier that somebody might die waiting for a drug. Any evidence that the FDA is?
Look, I can't give you a numerical breakdown, but let me give you some examples. In April 2003, FDA approved what's called a drug-eluting cardiac stent. It's a stent inserted into cardiac vessels that actually slowly secretes a certain drug in order to reduce certain side effects of having a stent placed. FDA took over a year to approve that beyond when it was already available in the European Union. And if you look at how effective that stent seemed to be in reducing cardiac complications from such procedures as angioplasties, it was by a factor of almost 3. And so if you just run a very rough calculation on how many people die from those things every year, you get a cost of that one-year delay of being on the order of 50,000 patients.
But, Sam, it's kind of a mug's game, is it not, to choose one example like that? I mean, I'm thinking of one from Marcia's book where she talks about this drug for diabetics, Rezolin, which was pulled from the shelves by regulators in Great Britain, and the FDA didn't move on it for 2.5 years in this country, and maybe they should have moved fast. I mean, doesn't it go both ways?
It goes both ways, but you have to remember, if your aim is to get zero surprises, some unexpected bad side effects, if your aim is to get zero bad surprises like that, the best guarantee is to have zero drug approvals. And that is the direction in which all this press about Vioxx and other unexpectedly bad drugs ends up pushing FDA, because you never have a story on anyone who died because they did not have access, say, to one of these drug-eluting stents. Those people are invisible. When FDA errs on the side of holding drugs off the market, there's no doubt that it causes immense medical suffering. But those people, those victims of drug lag, their stories never see the light of day.
Let's look a little bit at the drugs that actually are brought to market. Over the last 6 years, fully 78% of the drugs were classified by the FDA as being no better than drugs already being sold to treat the same condition. Most of these are Me Too drugs. Me Too drugs are trivial variations of top-selling drugs already on the market, trying to cash in on that market. Lipitor, for example, is the number one drug in the world. It's a cholesterol-lowering drug of the statin type. But it's the fourth of 6 Me Too drugs to treat this condition. They want to turn out a drug for erectile dysfunction, there are 3 Me Toos now for that, rather than make a flu vaccine because it's more profitable.
Okay, let me just take your own number here, the 78% of the Me Toos that get approved. What about the other 22? Are they being held up? Does Sam have a case to make here?
No, and that's the point. The truly innovative drugs, the drugs for which there is no drug already in the market to treat a serious condition, they whipped through the FDA in a matter of weeks. If you look at Gleevec, for example, which was a truly innovative drug that stops a rare form of leukemia dead in its tracks, that was approved by the FDA in, I think it was 6 weeks, a matter of weeks. AZT, the first drug to treat AIDS, a matter of weeks. They move very, very quickly on innovative drugs. It's all of these other drugs that take maybe a year, and the world is not in any hurry to get some, to get the next statin.
Sam, can I turn your attention, though, to the hearing that's coming up later this week at the Senate? I'm curious to know if you think there's a change in the wind here with politicians reflecting some of the public questions about the cost of pharmaceutical drugs and the way that they're being sold.
No, I think you're going to have a repetition of a history that goes back decades. And this comes back to a very interesting comment that Alexander Schmidt, who was an FDA deputy administrator several years back, made after he left office. He said in his tenure at FDA, he was called to countless congressional hearings to testify about why one drug or another had an unexpectedly bad side effect after being approved. He was never called to Congress to explain why FDA had delayed in approving a certain therapy. And in his view, the message from Congress is clear. FDA had better err on the side of delay and denial. And that, I think, from the standpoint of public health, is an absolute disaster.
I'm wondering, though, Marcia, in your perspective, you close out your book with a chapter called Is the Party Over? And you're talking about the way that the large drug companies represented by pharma spend so much on lobbying, spend so much on advertising. But ask that question for me in reference to the FDA. Are you seeing a shift here that might, in fact, bring more regulation or more distance between the FDA and the drug companies?
Not yet. I think the public is getting very concerned about the pharmaceutical industry, and it's no longer accepting their propaganda that they have to charge these high prices to cover their research and development costs. I think they're becoming very skeptical about all of the rhetoric from this industry. But the industry is still enormously wealthy, enormously powerful, influential. And it gives handsomely to members of Congress. So I don't think that the FDA is going to be strengthened in the way it should anytime soon, regrettably, because this industry is so powerful. You know, I mentioned that they spent 31% on marketing and administration in 2002, the top 10
right.
U.S. companies. That same year, their profit margins were 17% of sales, compared with only 3% of all of the Fortune 500 companies. So they are enormously profitable, enormously profitable. And they use that to co-opt anyone who might stand in their way, beginning with Congress, the FDA, the medical profession.
Well, I'll be interested to see what the politicians have to say to both the company, Merck & Company over Vioxx, as well as the acting commissioner of the FDA when that hearing begins in a couple of days. Marcia, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
It was my pleasure, Dick.
Marcia Angel, senior lecturer at the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School and author of The Truth About the Drug Company. Sam Kasman, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Sam is chief counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Earlier in the program, we talked with Mark Kaufman, reporter for The Washington Post, who's covering this hearing at the FDA. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.